It's tuned to Yesterday, showcasing programs from radio's golden era. I'm your host, Mark Levoner. In this hour, True History. Later on, from episodes of Front Page Drama and Fulton Lewis Jr. with the news from 1940. But first, it's the Battle of Hastings, dramatized on the You Are There series. The show is a marvel on radio in and of itself, as it dramatized stories from hundreds of years past with modern-day newsmen covering the scene. This next broadcast, not the highest fidelity, but some great historical information and drama, as they cover the Battle of Hastings from February 13, 1949 on CBS.
High noon has come, this 14th day of October 1066, the hour when William, Duke of Normandy, and Harold, King of England, will meet here at the instigation of His Holiness, Pope Alexander II. We still don't know whether this meeting is a sign that William and Harold have agreed on a peaceful settlement of their dispute. Harold, the Earl of Wessex, holds the English throne. William claims it. This was to have been the day of decision by arms, but the Pope's emissary, Bishop Lanfranc, arrived in the Norman camp, and soon thereafter this meeting between Harold and William was arranged. Since then, there has been no statement from either the Duke of Normandy or from the Pope's emissary which told the full story behind this dramatic last-minute conference.
October 14th, 1066, Hastings, England. You are there.
William of Normandy and his French army face Harold of Wessex and his English host. CBS takes you back 883 years to the meeting that decided which of these two nobles would become the undisputed King of England. All things are as they were then, except for one thing. When CBS is there,
you are there.
You Are There, produced and directed by Robert Louis Cheyenne, is based on authentic historical facts and quotations. And now,
a new camp at Hastings Hill, England, and on holiday.
Contest produced, if any, which would induce King Harold to discuss a peaceful settlement. Reports from the English lines time and again have quoted the Earl of Wessex as saying he has nothing to discuss. And he has been further quoted as saying, if William wants the throne of England, he'll have to fight for it. And that's precisely what William had planned to do today until the unexpected arrival of the Pope's emissary. John Daly's at the scene of the rendezvous in neutral territory on Hastings Hill, and he reports now that William is arriving, so come in, John Daly.
The Duke of Normandy has left his lines at the bottom of Hastings Hill and is coming up to this rendezvous, located midway up the hill between the two armies. King Harold at the crest and the Duke of Normandy's men down there at the foot. The Duke is mounted on a pure white charger and his official retinue apparently is coming with him. Bishop Lanfranc, the Pope's emissary, rides at William's right. I can also recognize William Fitzalba, the Duke's chief steward. And there's Count Alain of Fargon, the leader of the Breton contingent in the Norman army. We call it the Norman army, although William has drawn his men from every corner of the Gallic provinces. The Duke is dismounted. In a moment, he will pass here, and we hope to be able to ask him a few questions. He wears a white surcoat over his chainmail armor. William and Harold will meet at a council table set up at this point. It's a bright autumn day here at Hastings, and now... Oh, my lord!
Yes?
My lord, has King Harold agreed to give up the throne?
Harold, the Earl of Wessex, agreed to nothing, except to meet with Bishop Lanfranc.
Well, then His Highness is not meeting with you. He is coming here to talk only with the Pope's emissary.
That is correct. I, too, am here only at the Holy Father's behest.
But has there been no basis agreed upon in advance for this meeting, sir?
None whatever. The Earl of Essex and I have agreed to meet solely for the purpose of hearing a message from His Holiness.
And do you know what that message contains, sir?
I do not.
Well, suppose the Pope urges that you and King Harold divide England between you. Will you agree to that?
Absolutely not. I am the rightful King of England. All Christendom knows that King Edward, who has just died, brought his soul, was my cousin. We are the same blood. Before Edward died, he promised that I would inherit his throne.
But, my lord, Harold claims that King Edward promised him the throne.
If that be true, and I doubt it, my royal cousin was promising something he had no right to bestow. Harold is not of royal blood. His father's father was a swineherd.
But if I may, my lord, was not Harold elected king by the English Council of Lords and Prelates?
Elected? Quelle idée! How can you elect a king? Kings are divinely appointed to rule, not elected.
Then is it true that no matter what the Pope may say, you still intend to be king?
Let us say that before this day is out, I shall be king of England or dead.
Thank you, my lord. And now I'm going to try to ask the Pope's emissary, Bishop Lanfranc, a question. My lord bishop, will you tell us, sir, please, what message you have brought from the Holy Father in Rome?
Not now, my son. Later.
Are you going to propose a division of England between Harold and William?
All in good time. Later, my
son. There is a rumor, my lord bishop, that His Holiness favors the Duke of Normandy in this dispute. Is that true?
The Holy Father does not favor one of his children over the other.
Then why has the Pope intervened?
The Holy Father, ever mindful of the welfare of his children, desires that the succession to the throne of England be decided without the useless shedding of innocent blood.
Thank you, my lord bishop. The Bishop Lanfranc has joined the Duke of Normandy at the conference table. They seem impatient. William has risen. He's pacing the ground near the table, talking to his officers. It's now 5 minutes past the agreed time. The tension here is great. One can't help wondering what the feeling is down there at the foot of the hill among the men of William's army. There are 8,000 fighting men down there ready for battle. Approximately 5,000 of them are barons and knights, the remaining 3,000 mostly free men. And Ken Roberts is down there among them, so we switch you now to Ken Roberts.
Out of all this French-speaking host, I've been able to find a few who speak English. So, suppose we ask them how they feel about this peace conference. First, here is the Chevalier Hugh de France, a Norman knight. Is that correct, sir?
Oui. Oui, merci. I am from Normandy.
I see. And will you tell us how it happens that you speak English?
Fighting man learns many languages, monsieur. My third is for hire.
You mean that you're a mercenary?
Call it what you may, monsieur. He's one of the oldest professions, no? Is what you might call the trade of second sons.
Why do you say that, sir?
Because in France, where I come from, my elder brother Roland, by the right of, oui, primogeniture.
Primogeniture, you mean?
Primogeniture, oui, oui. By that right, my brother inherits all my father's castles and lands. So, what is left for a poor second son to do but to wander up and down everywhere, fighting a little here, a little there? That's how I make my living.
And that is why you come to England?
Oui, oui, monsieur. I hope that this will be my last employment. I want land and retainers to work the land. The Duke of Normandy has promised me plenty of both here in England, and for that, I fight for him.
Well, it appears, however, Chevalier de France, that you may not fight today. If the conference results in peace,
peace
you will
have... Peace or war, it does not matter. So long as William becomes king and pays me my land. Personally, I think this English Earl of Wessex is frightened. A means to bargain.
Both.
Third, if he does not bargain, also both. We fight. To me, it does not matter. So long as I get my land.
Thank you, sir. And now, here's a man from the province of Anjou, a freeman, a foot soldier. His name is Raoul de Marnac. He wears a leather jerkin over a quilted shirt, and he's armed with a sword and dagger. Have you also been promised land in return for your services to Marnac?
No.
Then you fight because you believe in William's cause.
Everybody in William's army believes in William's cause.
I see. You volunteer.
No.
Then why are you here?
I am here because I am a retainer of the Comte d'Anjou. My lord is a liegeman of the Duke of Normandy. The Duke of Normandy brought my lord, and my lord brought me. I am giving him the military service I owe him.
Well, I thought the customary term of service due a lord from his free man is 40 days a year.
That is true.
You've been away from home almost 3 months.
That is also true.
You must be very anxious to return to Anjou.
How would you feel, monsieur, if you had a wife and children at home and no land, nothing to gain here on this island but death?
I understand. Thank you, de Marnac. I hope you get home to your wife and children.
Merci. I hope so, too.
Well, I've just received word that King Harold has not reached the rendezvous yet, but my colleague, Don Hollenbeck, at the news camp behind William's line, has been granted permission to interview an English prisoner who was captured recently. And so over to Don Hollenbeck.
This prisoner is Swain of Kent. He's a member of that famous body of Harold's troops known as the Housecarls. The Housecarls are picked soldiers, Harold's palace guards. They're the elite of his army. I'm told it took 6 Normans to overcome Sir Swain, and I can well believe that. He's nearly 7 feet tall. He must weigh 300 pounds, all of it apparently muscle. He's wearing a steel helmet and a leather jacket armed with steel discs. Sir Swain, you don't seem a bit upset by the fact that you've been taken prisoner.
Those scoundrels caught me by surprise. I'll not be a prisoner long.
Well, is that because you think this meeting between Harold and William will end in peace?
Peace? There'll be no peace. Unless the Norman invader turns tail and runs for home like a whipped dog.
Oh, you regard the Duke of Normandy's army as an army of invasion.
Well, what would you regard it? There's not an Englishman among them. They come from all over Europe. They come to steal our lands and to make us slaves.
Slaves, huh? Well, I've heard there is more slavery in England than there is anywhere else in the Christian world.
We have slaves, yes, but they're Saxons.
Oh, I see. By the way, are you an Englishman? It seems to me that Swain is a Danish name.
My father was a Dane.
How did he come to England?
I came with King Canute.
Oh, Canute. Wasn't Canute the leader of a Danish army of invasion that plundered England?
Yes, but that...
And didn't King Canute drive out Ethelred, the Saxon king of England, and put himself on the throne?
That all happened 50 years ago. Now the Danes who came here are English. This is our home.
Well, apparently the English earls of Northumbria and Mercia don't agree with you. They refuse to acknowledge Harold as their sovereign. They point out that he himself is the son of a Danish woman. And
yes, I know.
Just a minute. Here's a report of activity up at the top of Hastings Hill. So back to John Daly.
Harold and his men are riding down now to this meeting place. He has only four knights with him, enormously tall and powerful men. They must be house cows, like the prisoner John Hollenbeck was just talking to. Each knight is carrying a battle axe. And they're by far the biggest battle axes I've ever seen. The blades must measure... or at least 16 inches across. Harold himself is in armor. This will be the first time that the Earl of Wessex, King Harold, the Duke of Normandy, have come face to face since 2 years ago when Harold was a guest in William's court. Harold, as you remember, had been shipwrecked on the French coast, and as is the custom with strangers shipwrecked on a foreign shore, he was held for ransom by one of William's noblemen. He'd probably have been put to death if the Duke of Normandy had not personally intervened and invited him to the Norman court. There, Harold and William became fast friends, and Harold, before departing for England, even took an oath that he would support William's claim to the throne of England when the question of a successor to the then reigning King Edward should arise. Harold has arrived, dismounted. He kneels before Bishop Lanfranc and kisses the ring on his finger. The bishop bids him rise, and Harold has now seated himself at the council table opposite the Duke of Normandy. The two men, once friends, now bitter enemies, are staring at each other. Neither has uttered a word. Bishop Lanfranc speaks.
I bring thee greetings from His Holiness Pope Alexander. His Holiness instructed the court of cardinals in Rome to investigate the merits of the rival claims to the English throne. It is the judgment of His Holiness, of the Supreme Pontiff, of Christ, vicar upon earth, that the rightful and lawful successor to the throne of England is William, Duke of Normandy.
I protest, my Lord Bishop. Neither I nor my liegemen were represented at the court of cardinals.
But, my son, you were invited. And you did not choose to come or to send ambassadors.
Aye, verily. What jurisdiction has the court of cardinals in Rome over the temporal affairs of my realm in England?
Oh, please. Do you dare challenge the authority of the Supreme Pontiff?
On what basis, I ask? Did the cardinals make their finding?
On the basis of William's blood relationship to the late King Edward. You yourself did recognize this relationship and its inevitable fruits of rightful succession.
Not true!
Witnesses, my son, unimpeachable witnesses, did testify that on the 8th of May in the year of our Lord 1064, at the court of William, you swore an oath to support in all ways his claim to the throne of England when that throne should become vacant.
Yes, I swore the oath, but I swore it under duress, and it is therefore not binding. Had I refused to swear fealty to William, he would have had me murdered.
You lie! You took the oath of your own free will, out of gratitude because I saved your life.
Gratitude? To you? All Christendom knows you for a poisoner.
You dare call me a poisoner? You, who could not even wait until Edward was coined in his grave before you seized his crown and put it upon your head in guilty hate?
I was elected.
Do you talk? You let me die.
Stand there out of your hands.
Stand there and listen to me.
Harold, Earl of Wessex, I read you this message from His Holiness. I, Pope Alexander II, do hereby call upon Harold, Earl of Wessex, to relinquish the throne which he has taken unlawfully. I further call upon Harold, Earl of Wessex,
to disband his army and submit to William, Duke of Normandy. Should the said Harold, Earl of Wessex, refuse to do so, we will place a sentence of greater excommunication upon him.
My lord bishop, I am a humble and obedient vassal of the Holy Father in all matters but this.
Consider carefully, my son. As an excommunicant, you will be denied the spiritual rights and comforts of the church. Internment in consecrated ground. The civil right to make wills and to sue in the courts. You will be shunned by servants, friends, and family. You will be an outcast, and the faithful shall call you Antichrist.
Call me what you will. I am King of England, and King I will remain.
Harold has turned his back on the conference. He is walking away, defying Rome, defying excommunication, and the... That's William who cried out, "Wait, Harold, wait. King Harold has turned, and now William is speaking."
Listen to my offer. Surrender the crown of England. In return, you may keep the earldom of Wessex. In addition, you shall have all the lands beyond the Humber River. You shall be the greatest earl in my realm. You shall stand at the foot of my throne by my right hand. We shall be brothers in arms. I make this offer to you because of our former friendship. Keep your friendship. And I will keep my throne.
Then let us at least avoid a bloody battle in which thousands of my liegemen and York will die. I challenge you to single combat. The victor will be king.
Single combat? Have you no faith in the valor of your army? Did you bring your host from France to challenge me to single combat? My throne is there, at the crest of Hastings Hill, defended by my valiant men. If you would sit upon that throne, climb the hill and conquer, if you can.
The peace conference has failed. William and Harold and their knights are going to return to their lines, and the sword alone will now decide who is to be the King of England. The battle will be fought here. Just when, it's impossible to say. It may even break and flow over this field at any moment. But down among William's men is now in the best position to follow this fast-developing action, so go ahead, Robert.
The Duke of Normandy is coming up to his line. His trumpets are sounding attention. It's hardly necessary, because every baron, knight, and foot soldier is anxiously waiting to learn what William will do now that the peace conference has failed. The Duke of Normandy has reined up in front of his men. He raises his hand.
William, William, let go, William, please. Send me a crusade to put his door in error. Il a destiné le pape à Rome. Il a accord le Rome de Christ.
William has just told his men the parole by defying the Pope has become the Antichrist. The Duke has been handed a banner. It's the Pope's banner, a great gold cross in the field of blue. Now, William again. William has just said that the Pope himself has blessed his banner. William just announced that he has ordered the Norman fleet to sea. There is no possibility of return to France.
Are not using horses, They plan to stand their ground on top of the hill and to force this Norman host to weaken itself in futile assault against the wall of English shields. Then the English hope to come down the hill and destroy them. The first line of Norman archers have shot, dealt, and now they're shooting thousands of arrows up into the air. You can perhaps hear the sharp, shrill clanging of their bowstrings as they pour arrows into the English. Their arrows are arched high into the air. They drop almost vertically among the English housecarls up there on top of the hill. And those arrows are having their desired and planned effect. The housecarls have been forced to raise their shields as a protective roof to protect their heads and their faces. And even so, housecarls are dropping. But still, others take the places of those who have fallen. And now the Norman archers are fanning out, opening a path directly into the center of the hill. They're blocking my line of vision. I can't see clearly, but Ken Roberts should be opposite me across the hill and slightly below where he can see, so over to Ken Roberts.
The Norman foot soldiers, with their shields and swords, are charging up the hill, racing up that path opened a moment ago by the archers. And behind them, the mounted Norman knight plants his head. Line after line of horsemen galloping wildly, pennants and banners flying in the wind. William is there somewhere in the center of the vanguard. I can see the blue and gold banner of the Pope. And now boulders, enormous rocks, are raining down upon the charging Norman horsemen and foot soldiers. The English must have loosed their catapults. They're taking a heavy toll of the Normans. But the charge, the magnificent charge of William's men up the hill continues. In a moment, the two great forces will collide. Go ahead, John Daly.
Two armies have collided, have crashed head on. Norman horsemen are knifing their way into the first line of housecarls, and the English, stunned by the shock of the blow, are falling under the lances and under the horses' hoofs. But now the Normans are being engulfed, swallowed up by the sheer mass of English soldiers up on the top of the hill, up there, lying about them with their heavy, mighty battle axes. More and more Normans keep coming up, more and more of them, and everywhere I look now, there are great, surging crowds of Normans and English giving and receiving blows, the great battle axes showing for a moment above the melee and then swinging down. It's almost impossible to draw a coherent picture out of such a savage and chaotic scene. Still in the thick of the fighting flies that blue and gold banner of the Pope. Under it is the white charger of the Duke of North. Now William has been struck down. At least he's fallen from his horse. And from here, it's impossible to tell whether the Duke has been struck or has been killed. If he has, it may mean catastrophe to the Norman forces. Ken Roberts is closer to that scene of action. Perhaps he can tell us. Go ahead, Ken Roberts.
I can't see the Duke of Normandy. The housecarls and Normans are fighting furiously around the spot where William fell. The Normans are wavering. They're giving way now. Many of them are falling back in confusion. Soldier, what's happened to the Duke of Normandy? Who is the Duke of Normandy?
The Duke is lost. The Duke, they do.
William has been killed, the soldier says. The battle is lost. The entire Norman line is falling back in complete confusion. All of the Normans were seen their Duke down. The English housecarls are seizing the advantage, striking with redoubled fury, and the Norman retreat is turning into a rout. The Normans have turned their backs on the enemy. They're fleeing down the hill, running past me in panic. And now, here come the English, led by the giant housecarls. They're pouring down on foot from the top of the hill, pursuing the Normans. And Harold himself is leading them. He must be supremely confident of victory to have left his sixth position. The English have overtaken the Normans now. They're cutting them down with their huge battle axes. The Normans are being slaughtered. William, Duke of Normandy, is dead, and his army is dying with him. This position is becoming dangerous, so I'll switch you back to John Daly on the other side of the hill. Go ahead, Daly.
We'll try it here.
This is Don Hollenbeck at the news camp behind the Norman lines. Go ahead, John Daly. Come in, John Daly. It's entirely possible the English may have swept over John Daly's position, too,
As you heard Ken Roberts report, William, Duke of Normandy, has been killed. The Normans are in full flight. The entire news camp here is breaking up. The Normans seem to be hopelessly trapped. Before the battle began, William ordered the Norman fleet out to sea, so there's no possibility of escape in that direction. Unless the Normans can perform a miracle, reform their lines, it's possible every last man of them will be killed or captured, and there's doubt here whether any prisoners will actually be taken. Harold had sworn to be merciless. The best any prisoner can hope for is slavery. Just a minute. We've established contact with John Daly. He's ready to report again, so go ahead, John Daly.
William is alive. The Duke of Normandy is alive. From this new position at the foot of Hastings Hill, we can see the Norman leader riding a new horse. A short while ago, at the very height of the Norman panic, he reappeared suddenly, rode widely into the confused and fleeing Normans, tore off his helmet, and cried out, "I am alive! I am alive!" And then he rallied his men, formed his lines again, stemmed, held, and turned the English tide of conquest. The English, out of their fixed positions at the top of the hill, on foot, have suddenly found themselves at the mercy of the resurgent Normans. I'm going to try to get up there to the center of the fighting. Meanwhile, I'm told that Ken Roberts can report again from the other side of the hill. Go ahead, Roberts.
The Norman knights are surrounding the English. The English, on foot, are helpless against the charging, rearing cavalry of William. They're trapped. The English are trapped. The French are herding them into a dense, disorganized mass, striking them down. Harold has fallen. His horse has been struck from under him, and his house calls are losing heart. Their resistance is weakening. Some of them are throwing away their arms, and the Normans are pressing the advantage. The fall of King Harold and the faltering of the house calls is having its effect on the mass of English soldiers. They are beginning to run away now in all directions. The last signs of organized English resistance is disappearing, and only a few house calls are still fighting around the flag of their fallen commander. But now they too are being cut down one by one, and the Normans are reaching for the English banner. It's down. The banner is down. And John Daly has moved up to the center of the fighting, so go ahead, Daly.
William's blue and gold banner has just been lifted over the very spot where Harold fell. The Earl of Wessex is dead, killed by a Norman arrow, and that is definite. Here is the Duke of Normandy himself. Here is William. This is a glorious moment for you, sire. You set victory from the very jaws of defeat.
Defeat, never. Issue was never in danger.
But the retreat, sire, your flight from the top of the hill.
A stratagem, sir, a maneuver. Planned in advance to crush the English from their roots, and crush them indeed. The fact that I was shot from my horse only helped to fool the English.
Thank you, your highness.
But you won't survive. The combat with the tail, nous attaquons, and roi de conquête. We are.
Congratulated his men, and they're now hailing him, calling him William the Conqueror. And conqueror he is today. The Duke of Normandy is the new King of England by right of conquest. Nothing stands now between him and the throne and the crown.
October 14, 1066. William the Conqueror wins the Battle of Hastings, and the Middle Ages begin.
You have been listening to the Battle of Hastings. Another broadcast in the series, You Are There, produced and directed by Robert Louis Cheyenne.
You Are There, on Tuned to Yesterday from February 13th, 1949 on CBS. And we move on now in this hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday with a broadcast of Fulton Lewis Jr. with the news from May 3rd, 1940.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Fulton Lewis Jr. speaking from the studios of WOL in Washington. Well, it appears tonight that the House Judiciary Committee really started something yesterday when they tried to kill off the Hatch-Dempsey Clean Politics Bill. I reported to you last night that the Judiciary Committee, after considering the Hatch-Dempsey Bill for nearly a month and after assuring the sponsor of it, Representative Dempsey, day after day that they would approve it before long, after all that, they suddenly took a vote yesterday behind closed doors and they voted 14-10 to table the bill. To set it aside for the remainder of this session, which would mean, of course, that the legislation would be dead unless the sponsors of it could get it to the floor for action in some other extraordinary way. That meeting was supposed to have been strictly secret yesterday, but it seems that some members of the committee refused to be bound by the secrecy rule, and so through them the story got out this afternoon as to just what happened in the meeting yesterday. And that story has produced a regular hornet's nest of controversy in the House cloakrooms all day long. It seems that the committee, the Judiciary Committee, already had taken a record vote on whether or not to table the bill. And in that record vote, each member of the committee knew how the other members had voted, of course. There was a margin of 7 votes against setting it aside. Then, just before the close of the meeting yesterday, a secret ballot was taken. Typewritten slips of paper, one saying yes and one saying no, were handed to each member of the committee. The box was passed around, and the member dropped one slip or the other into the box as he saw fit. And on that one, that secret vote, with no fingerprints, the vote was 14-10 in favor of the death sentence, a margin of 4 votes the other way. A shift of 11, in other words, all told. That is almost an unprecedented procedure in any committee of Congress, that secret ballot. It hasn't been done since the old days years ago when the machine bosses of the Republican Party ruled the committees of Congress with an iron hand. And the members of Congress in general were extremely critical today of that procedure. The attitude was that committee members who are passing on legislation for recommending it or not recommending it to the House should at least have the courage to vote frankly and openly within the committee, certainly. That if a congressman is afraid to let his fellow committee members know how he votes on a bill that they all have studied, it's likely to sit very badly indeed in public opinion. Now, in the meantime, the sponsor of the bill, Representative Dempsey of New Mexico, said he will bring in a petition tomorrow and lay it on the table in the House chamber to be signed by members of the House. And if he gets 218 signatures on that petition, it means that the bill is forcibly taken out of the hands of the Judiciary Committee and brought to the House floor in spite of the committee's action. Whether or not Mr. Dempsey can get those 218 signatures, that remains to be seen. We probably will know more about that tomorrow night after the petition has been available, has been exposed to signatures for a few hours. Now, there's a bit of news tonight from New York City saying that Mrs. Roosevelt appeared at a luncheon there today and made the presentation of the Barter Theater Award for the outstanding performance by an American actor during 1940. She made that award to Miss Dorothy Stickney for Miss Stickney's role in the play Life with Father. And thereby hangs a story, not about Mrs. Roosevelt nor the play nor the actress, but rather about the Barter Theater, which makes the award. Back in 1932, you may recall the times were pretty terrible for all of us, but they were particularly terrible for the theatrical world. The legitimate theater already had suffered gravely from movie competition, but to make it worse, the theater is one of the first luxuries which the individual cuts off his list when times get hard. Almost every theater in New York was dark. Famous actors, hundreds of them, were walking the streets, hungry and jobless, and without so much as a roof over their heads. It made no sense at all, of course, any more than the general situation made any sense in those days. Farmers going into bankruptcy on a wholesale basis because they couldn't sell the corn and wheat and pork and beef which they raised on their farms. Millions of people in the cities crying for those very things in return for the kind of work that they were able to do. But the whole system, whereby the people in the city could exchange their work for the things that the farmer had on hand, that whole system had fallen apart completely. It had broken down, and so everyone was suffering all around. The tragedy was that no one had a solution. That is to say, no one except a young couple among those unemployed actors, Mr. and Mrs. Robert Porterfield. It happened that Mrs. Porterfield had been a teacher for several years, shortly after she got out of school, in a fashionable girls' finishing school in a beautiful old town in the extreme southwest corner of Virginia, down near Tennessee. The town of Abingdon, nestled in a wealthy valley there, high in the Blue Ridge Mountains. That girls' school had closed down, and so had another one in the same town, like many other things during the Depression. And Mrs. Porterfield conceived the idea that the trustees of that school probably would be glad to have someone occupy those buildings without any rent, just to keep them from going to rack and ruin by having someone in them. Why not go to Abingdon, then, and exchange good theater for some of that surplus food that the farmers there had on hand and couldn't sell? And that's just what happened. Mrs. Porterfield got about 25 actors and actresses together in New York. They rattled down to Abingdon, Virginia, in the summer of 1933 in the strangest, weirdest caravan of broken-down slivers that you ever laid eyes on. And they set up the Barter Theater. They made their own scenery and painted it. They put on the best of the New York plays, And instead of charging cash at the box office, they accepted whatever the customers brought in the way of barter. Corn, kindling wood, tomatoes, potatoes, butter, jelly, canned, home-canned materials of all kinds. Nothing was turned down, and it was left entirely up to the customer as to how much he thought the show was worth in his produce. Now, getting back to the regular news, Congress overrode a veto by President Roosevelt today. A thing that's been done very, very few times in all the history of the New Deal. It happened on a Spanish War veterans bill amounting to about $7 million to give certain veterans of the Spanish War in the Philippines about $300 to $400 apiece for certain travel allowances, which they did not get 40 years ago because of a technicality at the time. The sponsor of the bill was Representative Martin Smith of Washington State. He pushed it through Congress about a month ago, but last week the president sent it back with a veto. Representative Smith immediately called it up in the House of Representatives, and it was passed over the veto by considerably more than the necessary two-thirds. Today it came up in the Senate. With virtually no debate, it was passed again by a vote of 56-3, so automatically it becomes law without the president's signature. In the meantime, it develops that the president is making a last-minute effort to try to push through Congress at this session another slum clearance housing bill. Congress passed one $800 million program along that line several years ago, you recall. But that $800 million item is about exhausted now. A year ago, Senator Bob Wagner of New York, the sponsor of the first program, introduced a bill calling for another $800 million. And that second one actually passed the Senate a year back. But it ran into a young David with a slingshot in the House of Representatives, 32-year-old Representative Albert Gore from Secretary of State Hull's old district in Tennessee. Don't be misled, however, by that 32-year-old business, because Mr. Gore really is, although he's serving his freshman term, is one of the is widely regarded by Democrats and Republicans alike as one of the most able figures in the House. He made a study of that program. He's not opposed to slum clearance, but he did oppose the system by which this program operated. When the bill came to the House floor, he made a 10-minute speech that was one of the classics of all history. When he got through, the House decided by an overwhelming vote that it would not even take up the bill. In the meantime, Mr. Gore picked up a companion in his campaign against the slum clearance program as it now stands, another freshman, age 38, Representative Mike Monroney of Oklahoma. One of the bright young stars of the House, and the two of them have been blocking any action on this bill consistently all through the present session of Congress. The House leaders have told the president there isn't even any use in trying to get this bill through the House at this session unless it's revised in such a way that Mr. Gore will go on the floor and tell the House that it's all right, that he approves it. This morning, Mr. Gore of Tennessee and Mr. Monroney of Oklahoma were called to the White House, and the president conferred with them in strict privacy for nearly an hour. When they left, they were most uncommunicative, but they told me that they were and are quite willing to help work out a revised program on a sound basis. I asked Mr. Gore whether he's planning to back down in his opposition to the housing program in its present form. He looked at his partner from Oklahoma and smiled, and then he said with a slow drawl, "We Tennesseans don't understand very well what that term back down means, and you know most Oklahomans are descendants of Tennesseans." That's the top of the news as it looks from here, ladies and gentlemen. Until tomorrow evening, good night.
Fulton Lewis, Jr. will be back on the air tomorrow at the same time, speaking from the studios of WOL, Washington, D.C.
Fulton Lewis, Jr. and the news on Tuned to Yesterday from May 3rd, 1940. That was part of his five-night-a-week program on the Mutual Broadcasting System, drawing close to 4 million listeners every night. This is an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. We close out the hour now with Front Page Drama, a Hearst newspaper's syndicated show that produced a staggering 500 broadcasts from the mid-1930s through the 40s. This episode, called The Bull with a Delicate Ego, heard on May 3rd, 1940.
Front Page Dramas presents The Bull with the Delicate Ego. For this week's Front Page Drama, The Bull with the Delicate Ego, is a dramatization of a most amusing story entitled Gamblers Who Bribe Bulls Not to Fight, which is to be found in next Sunday's American Weekly, a magazine with the greatest circulation in the world that comes to you each week with your Hearst Sunday newspaper. Join the millions of Americans who have made the American Weekly the nation's reading habit. Insist on the Sunday newspaper that gives you the American Weekly. Bullfights in Bosnia, one of the remote mountainous districts of Yugoslavia, are quite different from the traditional Spanish variety. In Bosnia, the popular pastime is a battle between bull and bull, and every such meeting provokes tempestuous demonstrations of community spirit, for it is the pride of the village herd that enters into a contest with the bull of the next village. Substantial sums change hands in the course of betting, which is a municipal affair. Each village bets on its own bull in one lump sum, and the sums won or lost are often very large. Two neighboring communities, Blasik and Ramcha, have long been rivals in the bullfighting ring. For years, luck alternated between the two. One year, Blasik's powerful black bull would gore its opponent from Ramcha. Another year, the new bull from Ramcha would drive his horns into the flanks of Blasik's favorite. Whichever way luck turned, the sport was always good. And neither Blasik nor Ramcha seemed to begrudge the other a victory. But last summer, the village of Blasik was supremely confident, for their bull was really a prize. The largest, strongest, and by far the most savage animal ever seen in the whole state of Bosnia. They backed up their confidence with the largest sum of money ever to be wagered. And in the village of Ramcha, there was a meeting in the village inn.
I tell you, this is a serious matter. We cannot afford to put up such a sum of money to be risked in a wager. If we lose, it will break us all.
If we lose. But I tell you, we won't lose.
And I tell you, we will. We lost last year. And the bull they had is 1-2-3 with the animal they have in Blasik this year.
Yes. Have you seen their bull, Peter Stranovich?
No, of course not. Neither have you or anyone else in Ramcha. But Inspector Lesnovsky has seen it. And he told me he has never seen such a magnificent animal in all his born days. He is a half hand higher than any bull he has ever seen. He weighs more than any bull he has ever seen. And what is more, he says he has never seen such an animal to approach this one in spirit. He is as fierce as a mother tiger. Now I ask you, what have we got to match such an animal?
Peter is right. We know that Inspector Lesnovsky would not lie to us about the bull of Blasik.
No, he would not.
What is more, our animal this year is not as good as the one we lost with last year.
That's true.
It is sheer folly to try to meet that big wager that the people of Blasik have raised to bet against us.
Yes, of course.
Wait, please. Wait.
Why did we try to...
Citizens of Ramcha, hear me, I beg of you.
Very well.
Now, good citizens, I don't blame you for listening to Peter Stanovich and Ignat Vreshki. They are good conservative citizens. But remember, too, I, Jerome Lachtik, have been your village magistrate for 30 years. During all those years, I have administered justice and advised you well in all your problems, have I not?
Yes.
I also have pride in the reputation of my village, and I say if we refuse to accept the amount of the wager put up by the people of Blasik, we will be disgraced forever.
Yes, that is true.
I am willing to put up the biggest share of our wager. So I stand to lose more than anyone. Yes, I am perfectly willing to risk my money.
Yeah,
I ask you one and all to place your trust in me. I know the wager is a big one. I know that the Blasik bull is the greatest of them all. I know that our bull is inferior. Yes, I say we will win nevertheless. I swear it. Will you believe me?
Yes, I think we should.
Thank you, citizens. Now, everybody go home. Get a good night's sleep and be ready for the big bullfight tomorrow. It will be our greatest victory.
Witness the battle of the century, the annual bullfight between the bulls of the villages of Blasik and Ramcha. And this year's fight promises to be a sensation. The stakes of the battle are higher than they've ever been in all history. The animals are the greatest ever to be matched. And now, being led in from the east gate, the big black bull of Blasik. And to the west gate, the magnificent animal now being led in is the roaring red raider of Ramcha. And now the gentlemen in attendance on each animal are ready. At the sound of the shot, they will release their respective animals and the battle will be on. 1, 2, 3!
Yes,
the big crowd, breathlessly awaiting the bullfight of the century, suddenly burst into gales of laughter. For when the massive, mighty mountain of beef from Blasik, supposedly a fierce, bloodthirsty killer, came charging down upon the smaller red bull of Ramcha, he suddenly stopped, and raising his tail high in the air, turned and ran away. Yes, like Ferdinand in the fable, he ran off and sat down under a tree, for evidently he had never learned to fight. There was great rejoicing in Ramcha over the surprise victory. But in the village of Blasik...
Stanislaus, come in to supper before it gets cold.
I can't eat, Mother. You go in. I'm too mortified to enjoy anything, even food.
Now, my son, forget that old bullfight. It's all over now. We lost it and it can't be helped.
It's all right for you to say that. You're a woman. But what if you were in my shoes and everywhere you went, people laughed in your face, made fun of you, pointed at you and sneered? Oh, look, there's Stanislaus from Blasik, the man from the village whose bull wouldn't fight.
Oh, you're oversensitive, that's all. Why, in a few days, everybody will have forgotten all about it.
They will not. What happened when I went to report for my military service as far away as Sarajevo? There were 100 men lined up on parade, and the sergeant took my name and address. And when I told him where I was from, he yelled out, "So, you come from the village where bulls don't fight, do you? Well, we'll see whether the boys from Blasik are shirkers like their bulls." Everybody laughed and joked all over the barracks. And I had three fights.
My gracious sake, when will men ever grow up? Now, son, forget all this foolishness and come into your supper.
Oh, it's easy for you to...
Oh, there you are, Stanislaus.
Have you heard the news?
Yes, Stanislaus, we've got good news. We were just coming home to supper and we were passing the inn. All the men have been holding a meeting.
What about? They sent another challenge over to Ramcha today, asking for a return fight for our big bull. And what do you think?
What?
The magistrate and the men over at Ramcha accepted the challenge for a return match. Yes. A week from Saturday has been declared a holiday, and that's when the return fight is to be held.
My stolen body. You mean they're going to raise another big sum of money to wager on another fight?
Yes.
Certainly, we've got to win back all the money we lost to Ramcha the other day. But this time, we are going to win.
Certainly we are. The men have had the bull out today, and he's in rare form. He was led near to two or three other bulls, and he almost tore them to pieces.
Yes?
He's ready to fight now.
Yes, he was ready to fight last time, but something happened.
I tell you, there was dirty work afoot somewhere. Those people over at Ramcha tricked us in some way or another. But they won't do it again.
Why, what do you mean, Stanislaus?
I don't know exactly, except there was trickery somewhere, and I'm going to find out just what it is.
I believe you're right, Stanislaus. And I'm ready to help you.
Good. Now come on into supper. Oh, you two, Lazar and Maria, come in and stay to supper. You can talk over your plans at the table.
That evening, young Stanislaus and Lazar put their heads together and tried to solve the mystery of just why their ferocious bull had suddenly turned tail and ran off. Nothing they could think of suggested anything logical. So they made up their minds to scout the enemy territory. On the night before the return fight, they stole over to Ramcha and hid in the hayloft of the community stable. At dawn, the village magistrate crept into the stable, and from above, the two young men watched him.
Can you see him, Stanislaus? What's he doing?
He's putting the halter on the bull's head.
Huh?
Now he's pinning on the rosettes and the blue ribbons. Now the medallion.
Rosettes. Ribbons and medals.
Now he's putting a floral wreath over the bull's neck. Now he's gone outside for something else.
Don't tell me he's gone back for more decoration.
I don't know. Here he's coming back. He's got a little tin bucket with something in it.
Oh,
he's dipping his hand in and...
Oh, my, wait. What in the devil is that terrible smell? I can't stand it. Gagging
me. Quiet, you fool.
Oh,
I can't stand the terrible smell either. It's vile, but...
Terrible.
He's rubbing that stuff all over the bull's back and neck. Now we've got the secret. Come on. We're going to spring a big surprise at today's bullfight.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are gathered here today to witness the return fight between the bulls of the villages of Blasik and Ramcha. As you all know, the annual contest held here a few weeks ago did not develop into a fight. In fact, it was almost like a quiet flirtation. The big black bull of Blasik, supposedly a fierce fighting terror, turned out to be a shy little calf. And the rollicking red raider of Ramcha just walked away with the prize money. However, it appears that the good people of Blasik were not satisfied with the outcome of the first contest, if you can call it that, and so they have demanded a return bout. Hence, we are about to witness another battle of the century, we hope. So bring forth the noble animals. From the west gate comes the big black bull of Blasik. And from the east gate, the roaring red raider of Ramcha.
Please! Speak around the red bull of Ramcha.
Ramsey be brought to the center of the field for inspection. One moment, please. One of the young men from Glossick has made a rather unusual request. However, I see no reason for refusing him. So bring the roaring red raider of Rancher to the center of the field. Go ahead, my young friend, with your inspection.
Thank you, Inspector.
And now come, men of Glossick. Smell the red bull of Rancher. He has been smeared with badger fat. The vilest smelling fat in the world, and our bull won't stand for it. That's why he turns up his tail, runs off, and the Rancher wins.
A riot ensued, and it was all the police could do to prevent the wholesale murder of the citizens of Ramshire by the irate citizens of Glossick when they discovered how they had been swindled. The affair created such a stir all over Bosnia that a conference of community elders was called to take a stand on the matter. The convention ruled that Glossick should pay back previous bets dishonestly won without delay, and that all bulls taking part in Badnja Bikovac all over Bosnia should hereafter be publicly bathed and scrubbed to prevent similar happenings. Never, bullfight fans declare, have the bulls of Bosnia fought as fiercely. Never has sport been so gory as in these last weeks when the bathing has been made compulsory. Neither red cloth nor baiting with pitchforks have had such a maddening effect upon the bulls as soap and water. You have just heard The Bull with the Delicate Eagle, a front-page drama based upon a story entitled Gamblers Who Bribe Bulls Not to Fight, which is one of the many entertaining stories, articles, and feature fiction to be found in next Sunday's issue of the American Weekly, the magazine with the greatest circulation in the world, which comes to you each week with your Hearst Sunday newspaper.
Front Page Drama, on Tune to Two Yesterday from the 3rd of May, 1940, a syndicated recording wrapping up this hour of true history on Tune to Two Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Livonier. It's been a pleasure.